Okay, if you would please find the book of Isaiah. We have been looking through sort of the middle of this section. I will tell you that on Jeopardy this week, I don't usually watch Jeopardy, but I did. There was a panel that came up that said this Bible character has 66 chapters in his book, and he named his son, and they had this big long name that started with M. And nobody on the candidate group up there could get that it was Isaiah, but you should have. There is an announcement in the bulletin that answers the question that some of you ask about. There is a session tonight at 6 to 7 in the Commons. And
more of the same jokes you heard this morning.
Yeah. It's comedy for the whole family.
Okay. We've been looking at a section that starts around chapter 28, and in those chapters, each chapter or every other chapter begins with woe to those or what sorrow awaits, sometimes twice in one chapter. You get to chapter 33 and you still see that, but chapter 32 is an exception to that, and that's what we're going to focus on today. Chapter 32. Chapter 32 does not begin what sorrow awaits, or woe to those who, and it names some group. Instead, it starts fascinatingly, inspiringly, and I would almost say hopefully. Look, a righteous king is coming. We've not had many of those. History does not record many of those. Even the ones that might have been righteous to some degree generally were not righteous through and through. So many of the commentators think this points to Jesus. But I find myself caught by what it says immediately afterwards. A righteous king is coming, and honest princes will rule under him. Political leaders, leaders of a country, do not manage things alone. They have teams of folks. And the picture of everybody from the king down being honest is attractive. And it hasn't happened yet. What I really like is verse 2. Each one, I think it's talking about the honest princes, not about the righteous king. The honest princes ruling under him. Each one will be like, and then it names four things. What's the first one? Shelter from the wind, mine says. What's the second one?
Refuge
from the storm, mine says.
Streams in the desert.
Streams of water in a place where streams of water are usually not found. That's the third one. And the last one? I don't know how much you have spent time singing hymns. I don't know how much you have spent time thinking about the hymns you have sung. But there are hymns that use that image. The shadow of a mighty rock within a weary land, I think is the way the hymn writer adapted that. Right in this section of Isaiah, we're going to see it for several chapters now. There's places in here that get referenced. Some of them referenced by Jesus himself. Some of them referenced heavily by hymn writers or songwriters. This is one of those. What does it mean for someone to serve as a shelter from the wind or a refuge from the storms or streams of water in the desert or shadow of a great rock in a parched land? What does that mean? Well, before we talk about that, and I do want to talk about that, I want you to look at the very next verse. Because in verse 3, my translation starts with the word then. So here you go. You got a righteous king. You have people functioning under him who are actually honest through and through, and who in their functioning serve as a resource. The picture is shelter, refuge, water where there is no water, shade where there is no shade. The guy that talked in the worship services today spent his whole time talking about shade trees. I didn't see the connection as being well made, but I saw the point being well made. You hearing what I'm saying? I thought it was a little contrived the way that he talked about it, but goodness, the point he was making was really, really interesting. And that's kind of the thing that's here. If this happens, if you get people functioning like this who are watching out for individuals and for groups, then, verse 3, everyone who has eyes will be able to see the truth. Everyone who has ears will be able to hear the truth. Even hotheads, that's my translation. Check what your translation uses at that spot. What does yours use at that spot? Yours just says rash. Mine says hotheads. I think that's a little better. Even the hotheads will be full of sense and understanding. Even those who stammer will speak out plainly. And then it says in verse 5, in that day, ungodly fools will not be treated like heroes, and scoundrels will not have the respect of all. Here's a different translation. Fools will no longer be called generous, nor will rascals be styled bountiful. There was an editorial column, I think, in some part, some section of the New York Times this week, where a guy was writing, and he said, I've been noticing the Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation, Buffett, lots and lots of people who have amassed lots and lots of money are putting that money into what they call lifting people out of poverty. Lifting people out of poverty. Nike says that. We're putting these plants into China to lift people out of poverty. And it seems to be working in China. But this guy said he took a trip back through his home country, which was the Delta of Mississippi, and saw town after town after town that had been ruined by the factories being taken out. And the guy was speculating. The speculation was, how much should we admire and praise this? Now, I don't know how well this verse fits, but I'll read it again. No longer will folks be called generous who are actually foolish. No longer will people be called bountiful who are actually rascals.
There are places to go to look all that up with these organizations. Yeah. And tell how much goes to the people running it.
I actually know how to do that now, so I can give you tips if you don't know how. Yeah.
Which verse was that doing?
I was looking at verse 5. And then it goes on to say, fools speak foolishness and make evil plans. They practice ungodliness. They spread false teachings about the Lord. They deprive the hungry of food. They give no water to the thirsty. The smooth tricks of scoundrels are evil. They plot crooked schemes. They lie to convict the poor, even when the cause of the poor is just. Verse 9. But generous people, your translation may say noble. A couple of translations say verse 8. But generous people, some translations say noble people, plan to do what is generous or noble. And they stand firm in their generosity. People who are generous plan how they're going to be generous. And they stand firm in their generosity. Now, what I want to try to do is put this whole thing together by asking, did you go to the worship service? Did you hear Dennis Swinburne? Is that his name? Did you hear him speak? Mm-hmm. I listened.
Swanberg.
I listened to all the things he had talked about. And I found myself drawn to one particular thing. Now, there's a reason I was drawn there, and there's a good chance you weren't drawn there. You were probably drawn to something else. But I was drawn to his story about the guy who helped him get into Baylor and how that guy had been helped to make it through Baylor by the generosity of somebody that he didn't even know who it was for years. Did he tell that story?
I don't think he talked about that.
Did he tell that story?
He talked about the football coach or somebody who completed Christ.
Did he talk about that coach taking him to Baylor?
No.
Okay. Turned out when that coach took him to Baylor, before he took him to Baylor, the coach told him a story about when he went to Baylor. He was going, his parents had disowned him because they wanted him to do something else. He was trying to make it through on his own, running three jobs, and still didn't have enough money. And somewhere out of the blue, money started coming. Didn't know where it was coming from. And it was always just enough to take care of what he needed that semester. Just enough to take care of what he needed that semester. And he said, I found out years later that the woman with me in the back seat of the car was the woman who had invested in him when he was a student at Baylor. She taught him in English for one semester during his high school time. And when he went off to Baylor, she started investing in him. And it was 20 years later, 15 years later, before she ever told him what she had done. She was a school teacher, never made much money. But out of what she had, she gave some money to help him. And he said, I didn't realize until years later, that was the woman sitting beside me. And he said, when I graduated, she was there. When I graduated from seminary, she was there. When I got married, she was there. Because she was investing in me. You didn't hear that story. Okay, you needed to. Because that's what this section, I think, is talking about. Now, there's something I do in my other life. This is what you don't know. In my other life, I teach chemistry at the University of Richmond. And in teaching chemistry, I introduce people to the idea of acids and bases. Now, you can talk about the Lewis theory of acids and bases, but usually we start with the Bronsted theory of acids and bases. It's really the Bronsted-Lowry theory, but we sort of bypass Lowry and just talk about it as the Bronsted theory. Now, here's the way it works. An acid is a proton donor, and a proton is a hydrogen atom that doesn't have any electrons. Okay, so acid donates protons, and protons are hydrogens that don't have any electrons. So I asked the students, and I'm now asking you, what's the minimum requirement for some chemical with some formula? What's the minimum requirement for it to function as an acid?
As an acid?
As an acid. What's an acid?
Hydrogen.
Proton donor. What's a proton? A hydrogen atom that doesn't have any electrons. Hydrogen walks into a bar. I think I've lost my electron. Are you sure? I'm positive. See, that's the... Okay.
I get the joke. I don't get anything else you're talking about.
What's the minimum? What's the minimum requirement to be an acid?
Well, as soon as you said that we're chemistry, my friend...
I know. She did, too. I saw her nodding off. Listen, you can do this. You can do this.
You've given up your electron.
What's the minimum requirement for something to function as an acid?
It has to have
a proton. It has to have a hydrogen that it can then give away and keep the electrons back. That's what it's got to have, a hydrogen, right? If it doesn't have a hydrogen, it can't do that. So far, okay? So what would be required for you to have a strong acid?
Lots of protons.
And that's what everybody thinks. And that's not so.
There are lots of molecules, lots of things out there with lots of hydrogens.
And they don't function as acids at all. In order to function as an acid, you have to be willing to let go of the first proton. You got to have a hydrogen in your formula, and you can have lots of it. That's not the issue. The issue is, are you willing to let go of one? And if you're a strong acid, you're insistent on letting go of one.
You take my proton. You take it. I don't want it. Keep that thing. Don't give it back. That's a strong acid.
One proton. One proton. That's all. I then asked them, and this is where I want you to make the shift with me, what is a philanthropist? Not a philanderer, don't go down that road. Philanthropist. What's a philanthropist?
Somebody gives away
money, right? Who is the most renowned philanthropist in the city of Richmond?
It was that mailman.
It was that mailman.
Do you have to have lots of money? What's the requirement to be a philanthropist? Most of my kids would say, you have to have a lot of money. That's not true. To be a philanthropist, you have to be willing to share what you have.
What's the deal with the mailman?
Thomas Cannon was his name. He gave anonymously $1,000 to people he read about in the newspaper who were in need, and he did it for 15 years or 20 years before anybody got wind of it. And he never made... He felt a sense of needing to share what he had. He never made more than $20,000, $25,000 a year at any one time. Had an invalid wife toward the end of his life.
You don't give out of your wealth, you give out of...
But he gave. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to get my kids to see. Strong asses don't have to have lots. They just have to be willing to give what they have. And most of our kids would know about Robbins because he's just everywhere on campus. A few of the people in Richmond would know about Lewis Ginter and maybe some others like that. But I'll tell you, there's more people who know about that mailman than anybody else. And he was not rich. He never was. But he was willing to share what he had. Okay? Now, you listen to what he said, and you listen to what this woman said. This woman revealed herself to the football coach about 15 years after helping finance his way through there. And she said, God told me it's time for me to tell you. So I'm telling you, I invested in you, and it's the best investment I ever made. I invested in you. And what Swanberg said this morning was, and then she invested in me. Not so much money, because that was not the issue for him, but it was her presence. She invested in me. So the question I started to ask is, look at this list up here. Honest princes, having authority under him, each one like a shelter from the wind or a refuge from the storm, streams of water in the desert, the shadow of a great rock in a parched land. Every one of those could have been a description of what that woman did for that young man who later became a football coach. Now, let me tell you why I caught that one. I caught that one because my grandfather manifestly showed his ignorance, because he became the treasurer of a college in 1928. Anybody know anything about the economic history of the United States? He was treasurer of a little college in East Tennessee, starting in late 1928 and going through 1957. He had 8 kids of his own, and he put them through college without any scholarship help that might later come to faculty members. I've met people who came to that little college over the years my grandfather was there, and I've had them tell me, your grandfather's the greatest man ever. He made it possible for me to make it through college. He found the money that made it possible. And I heard my granddad one time in his house. I'd heard this, and he knew I'd heard this. And he took me aside and he says, you need to understand something. They think I gave them the money. That money was coming from people who didn't want to be known, but they were looking for people to invest in. And they trusted me to find them. Find me somebody. Now, in the first hour, there was a gentleman sitting in that chair who, 10 years after my grandfather retired, was the beneficiary of this sort of thing in that same school.
Has
a woman.
You been that part
of it? I didn't know it until we met here. He told me a story one time. There was a woman named Pearl McCann who ran the dining hall at the little college. She gave him a job as a busboy and as a kitchen helper. You know why? Because if she gives him a job, she can feed him and not have it be taxed and not have it be part of this stuff. She can just, you know, he's working in there, well, you can have some food. So he ate every meal with Pearl McCann. Somebody else who was in this little town gave him a place to live so he wouldn't have to spend his money on dorm rooms. A group of people got together at one of the churches. They had been thinking about starting a mission point. They hired him, gave him a little bit of money to be the preacher at this mission point. He was a student preacher. And he said, I later became a preacher, but I wasn't much of a preacher then. But one after another, across this little town, people were investing in me. For a while there, a lot of that was coming through my grandfather, and I got to watch my grandfather get thanked by people when he knew the people they really ought to thank were just, they're all around me, all around me. And I listened to the words that Swanberg used. The woman said, you are the best investment I ever made. Jesus told a parable one time. You'll find it over in the Gospels somewhere. I didn't look it up, primarily because I didn't know I was going to say all this morning, because Swanberg hadn't started speaking yet. But he talked about a master who had a steward who was dishonest. Do you remember that one? Remember that one? At the end of the story, the master praised the dishonest steward. Do you remember that? He had caught this steward in some chicanery, and he was getting ready to fire the guy. And in that little bit of time the guy had left, the guy said, dig ditches? I don't think so. what am I going to do? So he started bringing in the people who owed money to his master. And he said, how much do you owe? Let's cut that in half. How much do you owe? Let's cut that in half. Some commentators say he was stealing from his master once again. Others say he was writing off the fees that would have come to him as the steward. This was the way he made his living, was off of fees. Whichever one it was, the master at the end of this praised him. And then Jesus said, the people of this world are smarter at using money than the children of light. You ought to be using money to invest in people so that when you get to heaven, there's somebody there to welcome you through the gates. Fascinating, fascinating story. And I find that interesting. So I start to think.
And at this point, I need to have my sign. It needs to be here, and I need to be standing on it because I'm getting on dangerous ground now. I'm not sure how well our church does at investing its money. We got a budget presentation meeting on Wednesday night this week. I don't think I'm going to think all that well about that because I don't think we think in terms of investments. I don't think we think in terms of looking at where God is working. In the first hour, we had a man come in and say, we need to pray for the village. Because the attendance at our village site is dropping. Half of what it used to be or less. And they don't seem to know why. Now let me tell you why that one picked up for me. I've got a student. He's in medical school now. The Air Force is paying for it. He's going to be an Air Force officer to pay them back when his medical school is over. But his long-term goal is medical missions. He wants to be a missionary. I don't know what all the backstory is, but somehow the State Department found out about this young man. And for each of the summers, while he was a student at the University of Richmond, the State Department paid for him to go and live in one of the major cities in Bangladesh. And what they paid him to do was to go into the marketplace and just talk to folks who were there, get to know them. I told him at one point, I said, you must be the only person I know who has a sense of what it might have been like to go into the marketplace when Jesus was here. They talk about the leading men of the city gathering at the gates and having conversations or talking to the market. He's seen that. He came to me during his senior year. He had had three summers of this now. He came to me during his senior year and he said, I am so excited. I have finally found a church where I can worship. Isn't that great? The church was a Bangladeshi house church. They worshiped in Bangladeshi. And he was right at home. He loved it. Turned out that's one of about 25 or 30 house churches that's being overseen by a member of our church. 25 or 30 house churches reaching language groups all in the city of Richmond already and serving them. And that man's wife was sitting where you were sitting. I didn't mean to make her cry. We have people in our church who know how to invest. I'm not sure as a church we're listening. I'm not sure we are. Would that God would give us, let me see if I can quote it right, honest leaders. Each one serving as a shelter for those who need shelter, as a refuge for those who need refuge, providing water for those who need water and providing shade for those who need shade. Because if we did, then anybody who had eyes to see would be able to see the truth. And anybody who had ears to hear would be able to hear the truth. And even the hotheads would be full of sense and understanding. And some who are only able to stammer now would speak out plainly. And we would no longer make fools our heroes. We would no longer look to rascals as people that we should respect and admire.
Can I say one thing, just to illuminate one little piece here on that verse in 2 that says, "And shadow of a great rock in a thirsty land." Probably in our way of visualizing, that doesn't sound so strong, a little shade. But it just reminded me in Folks Lama, where we were for 30 years, that it was so hot that the teeniest piece of shade, if you were meeting with someone, you got in that shade. When you parked your vehicle, you went for shade. It's so funny, you can see one little tree, and there'd be about 15 cars all trying to get that piece of shade, because when you would come back to your car, if it was not in that shade, the steering wheel would burn your... We couldn't hold on to the steering wheel without gloves or something until we at least got some wind blowing on it. But, I mean, I'm only just emphasizing that because it's such a good way that they described everything there. And maybe when we read that, a shadow doesn't sound like much, but it can be...
I'm using the word shade this morning
shade,
because
yeah.
of what Swanberg talked about. As I say, I don't think he made the connection with the illustration pieces that he was using. It didn't quite line up. But my goodness, the point he was making lined up. And I think that sentence, shadow of a mighty rock. Now, connect it with the rest of Scripture. What's the mighty rock? The mighty rock is the Lord. But I love the way he said people were putting shade trees for me to have their shade. It was awkward. It was awkward. It wasn't fitting real well. But I see what he was talking about. That's a pretty powerful idea.
It didn't necessarily mean you had to plant a tree.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He continued to use the shade of a tree, and that wasn't necessarily fitting the things he was talking about. But the point he was making, I get it. I like the fact here they offer you four different pictures. Pick one. I remember going to a funeral in South Dakota. My sister-in-law's husband died. Very, very unexpectedly. She had told him for years, "You are not allowed to die in the winter, because I'm not taking you back to South Dakota in the middle of the winter." We had a funeral in South Dakota in January. And I remember flying in to Sioux Falls, I think it was. And as we flew, what we saw was there would be farmhouses, and there would be a row of trees going east-west, and over on this side, a row of trees going north-south. I forget which side it was on. I think it was on this side. And nothing here. And we realized when we got to the cemetery, here's this line of trees down this side, here's this line of trees this side. It was a windbreak, because the wind was always coming from the north. And whatever that corner was, that was the direction the wind was always coming. So when I read that sentence and thought about shelter from the wind, I thought about that funeral up there. It was freezing cold, and I can't imagine how much colder it would have been if it had been another time. Now, let me jump down just a little bit. I hate to tell you that verse 11 picks on women, and I don't think it's fair. I really don't think it's fair, but verse 11 picks on women. It talks about women of ease who need to throw off their complacency. Verse 13, "Because your land is going to be overgrown with thorns and briars. Your joyful homes and happy towns will be gone." How long is this going to last? Verse 15. How long is this going to last? Verse 15. What does it say?
Until the desert. Well, it talks about the Spirit being poured upon them, but then until the desert becomes fertile field.
Yeah, but the word "until" is not used in that second phrase in my translation. Watch how this works. Until at last the Spirit is poured out on us from heaven, then the wilderness will become a fertile field. Mm-hmm. Then the fertile field will yield bountiful crops. Justice will rule in the wilderness, and righteousness in the fertile field. And this righteousness will bring peace. It will bring quietness and confidence forever. My people will live in safety, quietly at home. They will be at rest. That hasn't happened either. "Even if the forest should be destroyed and the city torn down, the Lord will greatly bless his people. Wherever they plant seed, bountiful crops will spring up. Cattle and donkeys of theirs will graze freely. Look at that phrase, wherever they plant seed. To me, because of the context that I've already told you about, that's the investment. You're planting seed. And what did Jesus say about planting seed? Sometimes it won't work. Sometimes it won't work because of this. Sometimes it won't work because of that. Sometimes it won't work. But every once in a while, it works. And you get a harvest 60-fold or 100-fold. Remember that story? Invest. And the best investment you can possibly make is investing in people. And I think that's what this chapter is trying to talk about. So let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the time we've had. We thank you for the opportunity to be together to study your word. We thank you for this picture. And we ask that you teach us how to be part of it. Teach us how to see where you're at work and to come and work alongside of you. See where you are doing things and go invest in those places, especially invest in those people. And I pray for my church, that my church can learn, as it doesn't always seem to have learned so far, how to be investors in the kingdom by investing in people who make a difference in the kingdom. And I pray this in your precious Son's name. Amen.